Talking History with Patrick Gagan. This is News Talk.
We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender.
And out of that silence came thousands of voices.
The strategy of the white man has always been divide and conquer.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Auch die Leute, Argus.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, we'll begin beneath the waters of Dublin Bay, where more than 900 known shipwrecks tell extraordinary stories of trade, travel, war, tragedy and survival. We'll explore a largely forgotten Ireland of red-coated soldiers, barracks and military patrols, and find out what the stories of the Irish who served in the British Army tell us about our complicated relationship with the British Empire. And finally, we'll hear about a remarkable 17th century manuscript and a telescope that may have been made by Galileo himself. You can send us your thoughts and comments to talkinghistory@newstalk.com and we'd love to hear from you. And we begin tonight's show with the shipwrecks of Dublin Bay. Dublin Bay, as we know, is one of the most familiar landscapes in Ireland, but beneath its waters lies another landscape entirely. More than 1,700 wrecks have been recorded off the Dublin coast, with approximately 900 historic losses identified within Dublin Bay itself. It's a story of victims of storms, shifting sandbanks, poor visibility, and some of the most difficult coastal waters in Ireland. And a new exhibition at the Dublin Port Substation brings some of these stories back to life, combining archaeology, archival material, and the work of the National Monument Service's underwater archaeology specialists. And the exhibition forms part of the extraordinary Dublin Port Archive, whose collections include some 75,000 photographs, 30,000 engineering drawings, and hundreds of historical registers. And the exhibition runs at the Dublin Port Substation on East Wall Road in Dublin until the 18th of September. And to talk to me now about the hidden history beneath Dublin Bay, I'm delighted to welcome back to the show Lara Joy, the Port Heritage Director at Dublin Port. Well, Lara, you're very welcome back to the show. And can I begin with the shipwrecks exhibition and the fact that when we look out across Dublin Bay, we probably don't know just how much history is lying beneath the water.
There's about 18,000 shipwrecks around Ireland. And if you look at Dublin County, there's just short of 2,000. But in the bay itself, just past the port, is about 900 shipwrecks. And that kind of shows you how dangerous it was to come into Dublin for well over 1,000 years. It's a very difficult bay to come into. And that's the constant challenge with Dublin. And the reality is that if Dublin hadn't kind of overcome its challenges as a port city, I don't think it would have become a capital city, because the risk of the loss of ships was colossal. Unless you had a favourable wind, especially on a sailing ship, you weren't going to get into port. And that's a big challenge of the bay, and that leads to the 900 wrecks.
So tell us about the National Monument Service, because they have this incredible underwater unit, and without their work, it wouldn't have been possible to put together the whole exhibition.
No, I'm a big fan of the team. They specialise in looking after these wrecks, but also at the moment they're in Lough Corrib looking at boats and wrecks there. So they're working on rivers, lakes and around the coast. And they have this amazing map on their website called the Wrecks Map. And you can go onto the National Monument Service's website, put in wrecks, and you get this map looking at all 10,000 shipwrecks around the country. And you can zoom in on the map into the various wrecks around Dublin Port and Dublin City and Dublin County. And it's just, you kind of get lost looking at them. But it's an amazing tool that they put together over the years, and led by a team by Carl Brady and others in there. They've done a wonderful job over the last 20 years to kind of protect those wrecks, but also in particular to record them. And it's getting better and easier, I think, to do maritime history now. Lloyd's Archive, the famous Lloyd's insurance brokers, they now have a full-time archive team and a museum, which actually is preserving those records. So it's getting easier and easier to find a lot of these information on these wrecks online, which you wouldn't have got maybe 10 years ago.
And why were there so many wrecks? Was it a problem to do with the sandbanks or the tides or the shallow waters, or was there human error and incompetence. How come there were so many wrecks, and how come it was such a dangerous place for ships?
All of those. The reality is Dublin Bay is very shallow. So, and it also has a series of sandbars, and the sandbars move during the winter months. So even though you might have had the latest chart to get you into Dublin, you weren't fully sure if you were going to get blocked by a sandbar. And also then you have the rough weather. So the challenge is that the ballast office, so the Dublin Port company that's there today, traces its history back as far as the ballast office in 1708. And we have the records going back that far. And what they set out then was to build the famous Great South Wall, which is still there today, and later on the North Bull Wall. Captain Bligh is always the person that we associate with this, but Captain Bligh was actually only in the city for about 4 months. But he was a great surveyor. He was the first person to do a proper survey of Dublin Bay.
This is mutiny on the Bounty.
Yes. And later on this year, actually, we have a History Ireland Head School looking at Captain Bligh. Was he a hero or a villain? And my take on it is that he was an amazing engineer, a great surveyor, but a terrible ship's captain. But he did a great survey. But this is work that's been going on from 1715, 1720, building this great wall of 5 kilometres into the bay. And once the two walls are built, the North Bull Wall is finally finished in 1825. That allows the weight of the River Liffey to come surging down and push all the sand into the bay. And that's when you start to get deep water into Dublin. And as I was saying earlier on, that was the challenge that Dublin had. Quite easily Cork or Belfast would have become the capital because of this challenge that you can guarantee of getting a ship in. And once the walls are built, you then see a huge dramatic change in deep water. And today, the port still operates that without those two walls, there is no port, which is kind of ironic since both walls now are national monuments and fully protected. So very important historical features, but also essential for the operations of the port.
I want to talk about the year 1807 because there were extraordinary losses that year. Two ships, major ships sank, the Rochdale and the Prince of Wales. So what happened there and why were those disasters so significant and impactful?
So those ships are leaving from Pigeon House Harbour, which is on the Great South Wall, which was opened by the port in the 1790s. It's still there today. You can still see the ESB power stations and the original hotel. So the idea was you went out to the Pigeon House Harbour, which is about 3 kilometres along the wall, and you waited for a fair wind, or the ship's captains did, and literally you hopped on board the ship when they got a fair wind and you got out. With both ships, they left and they went out into the bay and they never really got past Bray. The weather got worse. It was November. There was snow. There was sleet. They put out their chains and their anchors, and then they didn't work. And once you've lost the anchor, you're in trouble. And both of them get washed up along the south coast. Sea Point would be the main area that they hit. And essentially, the number of death, 350 soldiers. So again, this is the Napoleonic Wars. You're seeing large numbers of Irish soldiers in the militia being encouraged to join up into the British Army. So you would have had units from Mayo and other counties, Cork, on board the ships, joining up into the regulars, and they're all lost. You also see that the crews survive. So they're the first ones to get the lifeboats. So there's a kind of a conspiracy about that. Why did the soldiers drown? Why did the sailors and the officers get off? And the captain of one of the ships survives, so he's arrested straight away. There's an investigation, but it kind of peters out, so nothing happens to him. With the loss and the fact that you could go down to the Sandyman Strand, Marion Strand, Black Rock, and just see the large numbers of bodies. They're all buried. A large number of them are buried in local church graveyards. And you can kind of go and see those there today, and they're still there, an example. This leads to a big push, as well as the Great South Wall and the North Bull Wall, that you need to have what they call a refuge harbour, and that's where we get Kingstown or Dunleary Harbour. So Dunleary is designed that if you can't get a fair wind into Dublin, you go and spend time on Dunleary until you get the correct wind. And if you can imagine the huge amount of money that's been spent on this by the port itself, by the city, but also by the British government, to improve sailing into the city is colossal between kind of 1720 to for 100 years. So you have Dunleary being built, you have the walls, but you also have a large number of lighthouses being built. The port is also responsible for lifeboat stations all along the bay. So huge amount of effort is put into trying to make sure that the ships do get into Dublin at this time. But suddenly around 1822, you start to see steamships come in, and steamships then change everything, because once you have a steamship, it's a bit like the railways coming into Ireland. You then can have a regular service because they can kind of run a regular service from Chester or from Liverpool and later on Holyhead, and a guaranteed service. And that's a huge change in the 1820s and 1830s.
But there is a disaster then in 1854 with the loss of the Queen Victoria. And that's one of the greatest 19th century disasters in Ireland. So what happens there?
So that's a paddle ship. So that's your kind of standard steamship with paddles on the side. And it's coming from Liverpool. Again, bad weather, gets lost and ends up off Howth. And then it hits the rocks at the Bailey Lighthouse. And it stands to founder. The ship's captain then desperately tries to make land on Dollyman Strand and puts the engines into reverse, and he rips the ship apart, and it sinks dramatically there with, again, great huge loss of life. Between 15 and 80, we're never fully sure of the figures of people lost. Other ships go to the rescue, but it's, again, there's such a faith in a reliability in the steamship system that for a steamship to go down, sailing ships we're kind of used to in Dublin, but to have one of the regular ships that go between Liverpool and Dublin to go down so quickly and so fast was quite a dramatic experience. And also the steam packer company kind of suffers from it because people lose trust in their business.
Yeah, I was wondering about that, what the passengers thought and whether there was a loss of confidence and whether people felt nervous leaving and coming into these harbours.
But this is the thing, I mean, the numbers travelling back and forth, the same company would have brought huge numbers of famine refugees to Liverpool. You know, at its peak, probably 600,000 to 700,000 people left Dublin, just Dublin, to go to Liverpool. So you had two types of passengers. You had passengers who could afford to live, to kind of stay in a cabin. And on the Victoria, you had 12 cabins. But the rest of the people were deckers. So they were people who were paying just to be on the deck. So, you know, there was no protection. And you just stayed on board the ship. And if it was a nice sunny day, it was a lovely trip over to Holyhead or over to Liverpool. But if you were in inclement weather like that, you were literally kind of clamped to the ship and hoping that you would make it actually to land.
The story goes right up to the Second World War, mm-hmm. and there is the loss of the Irish Lights vessel, the Isolde. Mm-hmm. And that shows that despite Irish neutrality, this was a dangerous time for ships because of wartime mines and submarines and everything else that was going on.
Yeah, I mean, we kind of delight in the fact that we remained out of the war, but the war came to us, if you like. We had planes, we had over 365 planes of all nations crashing in Ireland. But also on the sea, we lost 16 Irish ships. And Ireland found itself in a very kind of precarious situation in 1939, 1940, because we were heavily reliant on English shipping. So say the B&I ferry company was actually an English-owned company at that time. So therefore, when those ships were then called up into British service, so straight away the service from Dublin to Liverpool stopped. So we were very reliant on getting our own ships and losing 16 of them ourselves, and about 135 Irish sailors were killed. And again, most of the attacks that are occurring, including the Irish Lightship, was German attacks. So it's mines hitting a mine. In the case of B&I, they lost two ships in Liverpool due to mines. And then in relation to the Lightship, it was an attack by a German plane. And then submarines have a dramatic impact. And this is despite the fact all the Irish ships would have had ERA on the side, the tricolour on the side. Eventually, they also had ERA lit up on in lights on the back of the ships. So you couldn't miss the fact that these were neutral ships. But they continuously attacked onto the last one in 1943, which is, say, with great loss of Irish lives. And it's a story that's not well known. So we covered that in the exhibition and also in World War One and the losses of ships, in particular the famous Leinster ship, which lost well over 500 passengers just towards the end of World War One, and other stories. So it's a very comprehensive exhibition and kind of gives every aspect of the shipwrecks of Dublin Bay.
And archaeology is able to tell us stories that written records simply can't. And you get all these different types of insights and details and find out really about the circumstances of the losses.
Yes. So the work that Nash Munns are doing, but also within the port, we have our own archaeological team led by Dr. Niall Brady. And they're looking at the wrecks. So more recently, we found a wreck last year within the port in an area called the Alexander Basin, which was a 19th century, probably a small coastal ship, which we found and did a detailed survey on it before burying again. And then during COVID, we came across a millstone wreck, which was a ship from the southeast, which was bringing up millstones to be used in Dublin. So we have no history about it, but we did find a large number of millstones which are taken from a quarry down the southeast.
So how are people responding to the exhibition? Is it shocking them? Is it surprising them to see that there were so many ships that were wrecked?
Well, as you know, I've done a lot of exhibitions over the years. What we're finding with this exhibition, that people are coming in and they are, you know, taking it all in to learn more. So it's engaging and they're finding out. As you say, I think it's the horror of it, the fact that the story in many ways has disappeared under the waves, and what we're doing is trying to bring that story back up and explain the kind of complexities of an island nation. As you know, kind of as historians in Ireland, we're kind of very much focusing on the land, we focus on politics, but the reality is, as an island nation, we're connected to the world and we don't have those links. We're kind of in a dangerous situation. And the times when they do happen is during war. I think the realization, World War One and World War Two, you become very isolated from the rest of the world if there's a world war on.
And do you think people leaving the exhibition will look at Dublin Bay differently as a result?
That's our intention. And then from the feedback that we're getting from people, it's very much that is their takeaway. The other thing that we're doing at the moment is we're doing bus tours around the port area and also boat tours on Sunday mornings. So people are kind of seeing the historical port, but also seeing the operational port today. So it's kind of the modern world, but also this kind of hidden past world.
Okay, so if people want to find out more, if the people want to go on this, what should they do? It's running at the Dublin Port substation on East Wall Road until the 18th of September. What should people do?
They should go to our website. If they go to the Dublin Port Company Explorer, they'll see the variety of parts of the port that they can visit. We have a greenway that goes along the north fringe, brings you down to the terminals, but also then within that you'll find details of the tours, but in particular how to get to the substation, which is right beside our port headquarters on Alexander Road. And if you look around the area, you'll see a lot of building, because we're about to open a new greenway next year, which will bring a greenway from the Liffey to the Tolka. So a whole new face to the front of the port.
And of course, it's absolutely free.
Yes, completely free, Patrick, yes.
Brilliant. Okay, well, my thanks to Lara Joy, the Port Heritage Director at Dublin Port, for talking to me about this wonderful new exhibition. And it gives us an entirely new insight into Dublin Bay and some of the tragedies beneath us. We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this. Welcome back. We're Talking History. When we think about the British Army and Irish history, our minds tend to think of rebellions, conquests and occupations. But what was it actually like to be an ordinary soldier stationed in Ireland during the 18th century? Thousands of red-coated soldiers lived in barracks across the country. They trained, drank, deserted, married and quarrelled. They interacted with their local communities. And because Ireland did not possess a modern civilian police force, soldiers were also called upon to enforce order. The army in Ireland numbered between 12,000 and 15,000 men and had its own distinctive Irish military establishment. And the story has now been told in a brilliant new book, The British Army, Society and Soldiering in Ireland, 1699 to 1793. It's part of the wonderful Irish Historical Monograph series published by the Boydell Press. The author is Dr. Andrew P. Dorman. And Andrew, you're very welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Patrick. It's a pleasure to be here.
Can I begin with, I suppose, the question of who were these soldiers serving in the British Army but based in Ireland? Because many of them were Irish.
Yeah, and this is a very important point to point out, that across the 18th century, for much of it, it's illegal for Irishmen to join the British Army. And yet we find almost 25 or 30% of them are Irish. So most of them are coming from England, a lot of Scots as well, often confined to their own Scottish regiments. But there are a scattering of Irish throughout this establishment, in and around, as I said, about 30%. But it goes up and down depending on times of war or times of peace. These men come from an array of lifestyles. A lot of them are agricultural laborers looking for a better job. The military, whilst it didn't pay particularly well, it did offer stable employment, stable wages, and of course a stable supply of food, which in 18th century Ireland, food security was a serious problem. So this allowed them a different career path, maybe a bit of adventure, and also a steady wage and food they could give back to their families too.
And it made the barracks a very important location and site across the country.
Absolutely. And there's about hundreds of them across Ireland. A lot of these are constructed in the early years of the 18th century. Most famously and most visibly is what is now Collins Barracks in Dublin City. And that was the largest barracks in the British Empire when it was constructed. It's one of the first modern networks of these barracks in all of Europe. as well. So this is a very novel concept at the time. And there are cases of towns bidding to have a barracks erected in the town because it's an economic benefit as well. Having 200, 300 men arrive, all needing food, clothes, alcohol in copious amounts, was a real economic boon for these places too. So whilst there is an element of imperial oppression as well, because the barracks, of course, is a symbol of the state, and we're in penal Ireland where the penal laws are leading to the suppression of a Catholic majority as well, and the barracks are a tool of that. At the same time, there are, as from a societal perspective, there's other elements to consider as well.
That's very interesting what you're saying about the barracks and how they bring a benefit to the local community, but they also bring some disadvantages as well. So are there mixed views? Because, you know, you're going to have some economic benefits, but you're also going to have a lot of soldiers who maybe doing some good things, but maybe also getting into some difficulties and trouble.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, unfortunately, a lot of the accounts that we have are written by the Anglo-Irish elite, and they would tend to be a bit more positive about barracks. It's very difficult to see what the general people thought about having a barracks in their town. But we can see some of the reactions and pushback, particularly in the cities. Dublin and Cork, we see a lot of instances of anti-army activity, and a lot of attacks are carried out in and around barracks, which kind of suggests that they're sending a message, because it's very risky, obviously, to assault a soldier so close to the rest of the army. But they tended to do that anyway. And a lot of these attacks are in very targeted ways. There's a phenomenon called hawking, whereby they would slice the back of a soldier's leg, not to kill them, but to make sure they couldn't march. It was an assault on them as individuals and on their profession, and also on their masculinity as well, because legs were a very important part of 18th century masculinity. So we have this genuine pushback on the military establishment at times when the military misbehaves. So there is a give and take there. There's an underlying tension between those two groups.
And your book really explores the kind of the complicated relationship and even what the complicated history during that time, because it's not easy to just give a simple answer for why people are reacting in that way. Some maybe for reasons of, you know, what we'd call now nationalism, but for others it could be because of a local grievance. It could be for many different reasons.
Absolutely. Oftentimes, riots take place for reasons as punitive as a popular prisoner is being moved to a different prison, and the rioters will assemble and try and release that prisoner. And he might simply have been a popular person in the community. There's no way of knowing exactly what his relationship is with the army, and the army are stuck between a rock and a hard place. And in some cases, rocks are being thrown at them. And what's curious as well is in Ireland, there is no Riot Act. There's no legal precedence for the soldiers being deployed in this kind of policing manner on the streets. And as a result of this, the soldiers themselves have to take matters into their own hands. And that often leads to soldiers firing on crowds, because it's the only thing they can do in that scenario, or so they claim. And from the kind of wider history perspective, and given the anniversaries that are taking place this year, it's worth drawing a connection between the Boston Massacre, which is one of the formative moments of the American Revolution, is carried out by soldiers that had been garrisoned in Ireland and learnt the ways of riot suppression in Ireland. So who's to say? Maybe Ireland's responsible for the American Revolution. That's a conclusion the book doesn't come to, but we can guess.
And you have a very interesting chapter on criminality, because sometimes the soldiers were arrested and charged with a variety of crimes, from theft to assaults to sexual assaults. So that's also an element of having these soldiers nearby.
Yeah, absolutely. At the end of the day, the army is a large group of typically young men. Oftentimes in Ireland, they're extremely bored and they act out. Their main outlet tends to be alcohol or visiting brothels and the like, and both of those can lead to cases of, as you say, criminality and sexual assault in particular. And when I mentioned that there were instances of civilians trying to break the criminals out of prison, the soldiers were also very open to doing that as well. And if they felt that a soldier had been arrested for a crime they didn't deserve, they would break them out of prison, because the civilian justice system was more severe than the military justice system. Their soldiers were more likely to be charged with or more likely to be punished in the civilian system, so they'll be broken out of prison. And this leads also to further rioting down the line as well. So I mentioned before, there's an underlying tension there. And when that tension flared, you can have riots across the city. And the soldiers oftentimes acted as much as a very well-armed and uniformed gang, as much as a professional military.
What was life like for the ordinary soldier in Ireland?
Very, very boring, I think, is the easiest way of summarizing it. a lot of the regimental accounts, typically they go into huge amounts of detail when they're on campaign or what's life like in Britain. In some cases, they might summarize 20 years of Irish history in a paragraph. There is not a huge amount going on. And the fact is, Ireland is only touched or attacked twice substantially in the 18th century, once in 1760, and then, of course, in the 1790s when we have the 1798 rebellion and the like. So the soldiers are leading a fairly inactive lifestyle. They're training to be sent elsewhere. They are aware that at any point they might get shipped off to the West Indies, so they're often maybe paranoid about that because that, in some cases, equates to a death sentence. And they were just trying to pass the time. Drinking was a huge part of that. And there's a lot of accounts from the soldiers trying to understand Irish drinking culture. And one officer suggests that the reason Irish people drink so much is because everyone's heard the story so many times, it's the only way to make them interesting because life is so dull there. Another officer suggests that growing potatoes is easy, so why not just also set up a whiskey still instead? So it's not the most enlightened viewpoint, but it really gives an insight into how dull they found their time here.
Because if this was England at the time, going around in your red coat may have a certain attraction. And even Wolfe Tone, thinking of joining the British Army during the American War of Independence, one of the attractions for him was he thought it would make him attractive to women. But I suspect having the red coat in Ireland, it was maybe you'd get much more mixed reactions.
I think so. There are plenty of cases of recruiters trying to use that sort of logic. They particularly say that women in Ulster were very fond of a man in uniform, and there's some of the Scottish Highland regiments push that rhetoric as well. But I think in Ireland it's a different story. But interestingly, when soldiers desert, they often find safe harbour among the Irish Catholic population. And there's one case, a chap called William Burke, who's found to be particularly good at hunting these people down because he speaks Irish. And he's able to go among the local population and speak their language. And they're amazed that he comes back alive. And he catches a number of these soldiers in the 1770s. Now, he subsequently also deserts. So clearly loyalty to the force, maybe not so much. But yeah, that sort of, there was always going to be this difficulty in how is it exactly that a soldier comes to marry into a Irish family and potentially take that woman out of her family and ship her abroad? Because Irish soldiers and Irish women were not technically allowed to marry. And if they did, the women would be punished. So that often led to a lot of friction and a lot of women being kidnapped and shipped away kind of against their will.
Yes, I'm reading here about despite the stability of the service, marriage was discouraged and sometimes prohibited. And whether it was a Popish priest in their document, a Protestant minister or any other person whatsoever, if they marry a soldier enlisted in the King's Army, that's going to cause all kinds of trouble. So they really did try to put these blocks and obstacles in the way.
Yeah, definitely. And it's curious that they mention Popish and Protestant there. This was seen as a bad thing for the army as a whole. In general, the army's role in Ireland was what, in the main, to suppress local unrest and protect it from invasion, but also it was to be shipped elsewhere. It was a barracks for the empire. And as a result, if you have lots of soldiers marrying, setting up ties, putting down roots, and then they're shipped abroad, that leads to a huge amount of friction and might encourage desertion. So it was regarded as a bad thing if they fostered too many close ties with the community. And it's also in part of that, they were constantly moved around Ireland to prevent that from happening. Despite that, obviously, humans are humans and they're still going to get married and the like and engage in these relationships. But it was always, the army was not a huge fan of this.
And you have an incredible story of a soldier and his friend approached a priest wanting the priest to marry the soldier to a local girl, and the priest refused. And the soldier was so enraged, he stabbed the priest, and it seems stabbed him to death because there was no hope of him recovering. So this did lead to some considerable tensions.
Absolutely. And that is a story that's borne out quite a lot. The military would often resort to violence if they didn't get their way. There's another case I have of in a tavern in Bray where a soldier is gambling and he is accused of cheating and he stabs the barman in the groin, which is, it seems like a bit of an overreaction to me to being accused of cheating at cards. But these cases are very common, and 18th century Ireland was quite a violent society. James Kelly has written extensively on this, as have others. And that violence, when you combine it with men who are trained to kill and that overarching attitude towards violence could lead to a lot of very dark cases like the one you just described.
You mentioned the American War of Independence and the fact that so many of the soldiers stationed in Ireland, they were really only there in a way to pass the time until they were needed somewhere more important. Did that create tensions then in terms of the Irish elite, in terms of Irish politicians and even Irish society? The fact that you had a lot of soldiers here, but at the first sign of trouble, they're going to be sent somewhere else.
Yeah, definitely. That tension really governs the relationship between soldier and society, soldier and politician as well in this period. Because from the Irish elite's perspective, this force is there to protect Ireland and to protect them, to maintain that status quo and to prevent any sort of Catholic insurgency. So when the cause of empire are acquired and soldiers are shipped out to Europe, India, North America, you may, nominally speaking, supposed to have 12,000 men on the island. In reality, you're looking at maybe 6, 7, 8,000, far less than what is needed. And it is often at those periods where we see spikes in urban unrest in Dublin city centre, for example. As the garrison thins, gangs are more easily able to assert themselves. And often because the garrison has thinned, they're more likely to resort to violence because they don't have the manpower to do anything preemptive. So they have to be very reactionary. And as mentioned, with the lack of legislative support, this could be a tinderbox ready to explode.
Because then you have France entering the war in 1778 on the side of the American colonists. That's leaving Ireland vulnerable. And you have the Irish Volunteer Corps companies setting up then. So it is a dangerous time and probably not a good time to be sending a lot of these soldiers abroad.
Yeah, it seemed like a great idea when it was just dealing with the colonies. But as you say, as France and also Spain start getting involved and the prospect of an invasion becomes far more likely, they have to turn to these volunteer movements. And in the 18th century, the ideal from a lot of people, particularly Jonathan Swift and others, was that society would be self-policing. There wouldn't be a need for a military to operate as a police force because militaries are tyrannical and they're a tool of the state. So these volunteer movements were really popular because they were seen as harking back to how society should operate. They end up filling in for the military in a lot of cases, performing a lot of the actions the military was trying to perform. And at first, this is welcomed and they're seen as working together and cooperating. But then further down the line, we see that there's tension between the two, and this could lead to violence between the two organizations as well.
You've mentioned policing there because given the absence of a fully functioning independent, you know, a proper police force, the army does have to step in on those occasions.
Yeah, and as I mentioned, there is no overarching legislative support for this. So you have, and militaries have proven themselves to be terrible police forces throughout history, even looking at the modern day. So when you give almost free rein to this organization to operate as a police force with very limited oversight, it's not the best solution to a problem. It's all they've got. And the state does tend to rely on the army a little bit too much. The Revenue Commission in particular constantly calls on soldiers. And the officers themselves get very frustrated with this. They see it as a poor deployment of their men. It's not soldiering. This is policing. This is not what we're here for. And sometimes they just outright refuse to send their soldiers off to at the whim of whatever civil authority needs them.
There's a lot of times when you challenge maybe some of the lazy stereotypes or the established stereotypes about the army in Ireland, that it's perhaps not as ineffective as it's sometimes portrayed. The rates of desertion aren't as high as might be claimed or imagined, and that you're challenging the way the story has maybe been told up till now.
Yes. Typically speaking, historians look down upon the British Army in Ireland in this period. It's seen as a backwater, career suicide, and regiments that are here slowly degrade and fall apart over time. And the fact of the matter is, that wasn't the case. These regiments are going to be shipped elsewhere. It was in their interests to be maintained at a high standard that could be readily deployed to North America in a time of crisis, for example. You mentioned desertion as well. There's one letter refers to 1/6 of the establishment deserting over the course of 1 year. But it turns out when I actually found that letter and went through it, that wasn't the case at all. What he was actually complaining about was the length of contract that soldiers were being given. They were being told they were signing up for 7 years, and then it was being switched to a permanent contract for the rest of their lives. Now, as an early career academic with impermanent contracts, that doesn't sound too bad to me. But at the time, it was, of course, a source of serious concern, and lots of desertions were being created as a result of this. So he wasn't necessarily talking about the problem of desertion. He was talking about contracts, and he was making a point. So this is a really interesting case of how one letter can lead to a lot of stereotyping and misinformation being spread among academic historians as a result.
You end the book with the infamous put down by General Abercrombie of the Irish Army and saying that it wasn't dangerous and it wasn't effective. Was that too harsh, or was he getting at a problem, a flaw inherent in the system?
Well, he seems incredibly prophetic, because when we see what happens in 1798, we see pike-armed Irish rebels defeating the British Army, and the British Army fleeing from the French when they land as well. But he was writing that when he was planning on retiring. This is essentially his final letter before he leaves the position of Lord Lieutenant in Ireland, or Commander-in-Chief in Ireland, sorry. And as a result, we have to take it with a pinch of salt. He was a very angry man at that point. And I don't think it's necessarily fair. And when we look at the combat record of Irish regiments, be it in Ireland, when the French land in 1760, they do a reasonable job of resisting. And when we look at the combat record of soldiers from Ireland when they're sent elsewhere, be it the Seven Years' War, American War of Independence, and later on in the Napoleonic Wars, they fight as well as regiments based out of Scotland or the UK or the British mainland. So,
okay, well, it's an important new study. It's called The British Army, Society and Soldiering in Ireland, 1699 to 1793. It's part of the Irish Historical Monograph series published by the Boydell Press. The author is Andrew Dorman. And Andrew, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We'll be back with more Talking History and a Galileo telescope right after this. Welcome back. We're Talking History. And to end the show tonight, we are going to talk about the telescope, because few objects have transformed human understanding as dramatically, and few names are more associated with that transformation than Galileo. But despite Galileo's fame, remarkably little detailed technical evidence survives about the telescopes he actually made. Now, research at the University of Limerick into a previously overlooked 17th century manuscript has uncovered what may be the most detailed technical analysis yet of a telescope potentially made by Galileo himself. And to talk to me about these remarkable discoveries, I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. Jose Maria Moreno Madrid, a researcher at the University of Limerick School of History and Geography. Jose, you're very welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Can we begin with the discovery itself? What exactly have you discovered in this manuscript?
Well, so if the attribution to Galileo holds, this could be the most detailed technical description of a telescope made by Galileo. And then also it's relevant as well, because it's a four-lens terrestrial telescope, and this is an optical configuration that it was thought to first existed in the 1640s. And now Galileo would have been experimenting with this kind of configuration in the late 1620s, early 1630s.
And how significant are the technical observations in this manuscript?
Well, it has all of the measurements. It has diagrams of all of the pieces in the telescope. So we have nothing like this for any other telescope made by Galileo. Also, it's interesting because, you know, Galilean telescopes are these telescopes with two lenses, right? We had no evidence that Galileo was making telescopes of this kind. So it could be kind of an irony to have like the only full technical description of a Galilean telescope being a four-lens telescope instead of the classic Galilean telescope.
And I think Galileo liked to say that he didn't sell his telescopes, but he sometimes gave them away. And that was to help with patronage and to help with these important royal connections.
That's absolutely right. I mean, that's one of the things that I had to take into account when trying to find how this telescope ended up in the hands of a vice king, of a viceroy in Mexico City. Galileo, he said himself that he would never sell any of his instruments. He would only give them in exchange for scientific patronage. Yep.
So how important was the telescope? How much did it change the world and our understanding of the world beyond our own planet?
Well, in the case of Galileo, it was important because of the astronomical observations he made. Some of them were proofs or were indications that the geocentric system that was the predominant system since Aristotle and Ptolemy, it might not be the way in which the universe was actually made, or kind of the universe was in reality, right? So maybe the most one of the best proofs for this was the faces of Venus, right? Observing that Venus has faces, so that means that then Venus has to revolve around the sun, right? Or also the famous satellites of Jupiter, right? That means that not every body, not every celestial body, revolves around the Earth, but you know, there are, you know, other celestial objects revolving around other celestial objects as well.
So tell me about this manuscript. It was written in 1666 by a Spanish Dominican friar. And tell me about who he was and what he describes in it and how he attributes it to Galileo.
Well, it's quite a colorful character. It's apparently, you know, an unremarkable figure. He wasn't really studied by the previous historiography. He was born in Spain around 1608, 1612. And then he entered the Order of Preachers in 1628, and probably he studied there some scientific, some astronomy, some mathematics, some scientific subjects. And then in 1634, he sailed to the Philippines in missionary work to join the province, the Dominican province of Our Lady of the Rosary. And then he participated in a revolt to establish an illicit congregation in Manila, in the Philippines. So because of this, this ended up being a violent revolt. He was expelled from the province, and he had to go into exile. So he goes to Portuguese India, and he remains there until for 20 years, from 1640 to 1660, roughly. And this is interesting because at this time, Portuguese India was a territory that was also at war with Spain. Portugal was fighting its war of independence against the Hispanic monarchy. So he remained for two decades in a rival territory, let's say. And then from there, he sailed again to the Philippines in 1660, probably hoping that this violent revolt had been forgotten already. And from there, he wrote to the King of Spain, to Philip IV, and said, look, I have a project to improve the performance of Hispanic fleets all around the world, you know, with nautical science and so on. So if you pay me for my travel to Madrid, I will, you know, I will put this project, I will, you know, hand you this project.
And the king accepted. And what does that lead to then?
So the king accepted to pay, and then Muñoz embarked in the Manila Galleon route. So he traveled through across the Pacific, and he makes the usual stopover in New Spain, right? What is Mexico today? And then in Mexico City, he meets the vice king of New Spain, which is this Marquis of Mancera. Mancera is a very interesting man as well. He was very interested in the humanities and also scientific subjects. And he was suspecting that Muñoz was actually tricking the king into paying for his travels. He knew of his, you know, story of his reputation, obscure reputation in the Philippines, participating in that violent revolt. And he thought that he was actually no scientist, and it was all a lie, right? To escape the Philippines and to find a position in Madrid. So he decided to submit Muñoz to some scientific tests. And analyzing this telescope is one of the scientific tests that Muñoz had to do for the vice king. This is the origin of the manuscript.
And what it shows is that Galileo may have been involved, and these four lens telescopes may have been developed earlier than we believe that they were.
Well, it means that Galileo knew much more about optics that we thought. Also that probably was linked to his strategies of patronage that have been, you know, very well studied by Mario Biagioli and others. Because this the telescope that Muñoz analyzes in this document could have reached Mancera only as a gift, right? As we were saying before. So Galileo was trying to win the prize for the so-called Longitude Prize that the Spanish Crown was offering in the 1620s, and so he wanted to give something fascinating to the king, right? So it's in this moment in the late 1620s, 1630s that Galileo sends three telescopes to Madrid. So he sends one big telescope to the king, and then two small telescopes to the queen. And so, you know, this new configuration, this is something different, this is something new. It could be something really interesting, really fascinating for the monarchs of Spain. You know, the monarchs that Galileo wanted to win over to improve his chances to win this prize for the longitude problem, solving the longitude problem.
How certain are you that this can be attributed to Galileo and that we can see Galileo's fingerprints all over this?
I am not 100% certain, and this is something that I say in the paper. Actually, the title of the paper is a question. This is just a hypothesis. We have to be really cautious about this attribution, because it's only one document. It's clear that the text says telescope fabricatum a Galileo in Latin, so manufactured, fabricated by Galileo. Further scrutiny could not resist further scrutiny. This attribution for several reasons. One of them is actually the, you know, this configuration that is so in advance, you know, predating two decades, this kind of optical configuration. It is true that the lenses, the first lens, the one that is close to the eye, and the lens that is at the end of the telescope, those make sense with what Galileo was making in the Galilean telescope. So it's a concave lens, and then it's a plano convex lens on the other side. So this makes sense. What is really new is the extra lenses in the compound eyepiece. So this means that it could also be an addition to an actual Galilean telescope. It could be one of these telescopes that Galileo sent to the king or to the queen. But then it was added later. The two lenses were added later. It is true also that the telescope that Galileo sent to the Spanish king, it was a terrestrial telescope. So the king was using it for observation of the landscape. So it was probably conceived to be for terrestrial use. And this also makes sense. It fits the description of the telescope described by Muñoz. But as I was saying, I mean, in the document, the attribution is clear, we have to, you know, to keep doing research and to find more evidence, more documentation about this telescope.
And finally, why were telescopes considered so important at that time? Was it because they were useful or essential, integral to new scientific discoveries? Or was it also that they were a symbol of prestige and wealth and your status in society? And that's why they were so prized by monarchs and the elite?
I think it's actually both, because there were telescopes that were being used before Galileo, right, in the Netherlands, probably 1608, I think is the oldest one that we have. But they were using telescopes also for terrestrial purposes, so they were very useful at war, for example. But then, you know, with the discoveries of Galileo, the astronomical discoveries of Galileo, they also became kind of a symbol of the, you know, the scientific revolution or the new scientific discoveries of the 17th century, and of course they were also very exclusive objects. Galileo always used them as an object to attain scientific patronage, and also other people. In my other research with nautical science, planispheric astrolabes were as well objects of prestige. So I think it's both sides, right? They were very useful for both practical purposes and also for astronomical observation, but as well, you know, they were exclusive instruments that were not that common, especially those that were, you know, really well crafted, like those of Galileo. So this is why also they became so so famous and so relevant in the early modern period.
Well, my thanks to Dr. Jose Maria Moreno Madrid, a researcher at the University of Limerick School of History and Geography, for joining me tonight to share this remarkable story. Well, that does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to my producer, Mairéis O'Sullivan, for bringing everything together. We have more debate and discussion next week, so hope you can join us then. We've been Talking History. Good night.
There once was a ship that put to sea. The name of the ship was a Bully of Tea. The winds blew up her bow, dipped down, oh, below my bully boys blow. Soon may the willowman come to bring us sugar and tea and rum. One day when the tonguing is done, we'll take our leave and go. She'd not been 2 weeks from shore when down on her a right whale bore. The captain called all hands and swore he'd take that whale in tow. Soon may the willowman come to bring her sugar and tea and rum. One day when the tonguing is done, we'll take her leave and go. Da 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 da. Before the boat had hit the water, the whale's sail came up and caught her. Hands to the side, harping and fought her when she dived down low. Soon may the willowman come to bring us sugar and tea and rum. One day when the tonguing is done, we'll take our leave and go. No line was cut, no whale was freed. The captain's mind was not of greed, and he belonged to the whaleman's creed. She took that ship in tow. Soon may the willowman come to bring us sugar and tea and rum. One day when the tonguing is done, we'll take our leave and go. Da 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 da. For 40 days or even more, the line went slack, then tight once more. All boats were lost, there were only four, but still that whale did go. Soon may the willowman come to bring us sugar and tea and rum. One day when the tonguing is done, we'll take our leave and go. As far as affair, the fight's still on. The line's not cut and the whale's not gone. The willowman makes his regular call to encourage the captain, crew and all. Soon may the willowman come to bring us sugar and tea and rum. One day when the tonguing is done, we'll take our leave and go. Soon may the willowman come to bring us sugar and tea and rum. One day when the tonguing is done, we'll take our leave and go.